This is Shannon. I host the Ag Discussion Forum, and I hope that you enjoy this. Our purpose here is to give you the news, educate, and allow an open, honest, and transparent discussion about what is going on in agriculture. Welcome, enjoy, and I hope that you stimulate some questions. Hopefully you come to some answers, and I look forward to engaging with you in any way we can.
So the first thing we're talking about today is not an article, but an actual subject that I actually had to do some homework for to get ready for it. So, the Dust Bowl. Oops. The Dust Bowl in the 1930 to 1936 period brought a lot of drought, severe drought, a lot of very, very, very poor farming practices, but especially today's standards, and that led to the massive dust storms across the Great Plains. Thousands of families, especially those people from Oklahoma and Texas, headed west. During the Great Depression, unemployment peaked at almost 25%+. Thousands of banks failed. A lot of people lost pretty much everything. And shanty towns appeared as people lost homes. President Roosevelt launched a lot of federal programs. One of them, the CCC, the Civilian Conservation Corps, gave people a lot of jobs to help them along. The WPA, the Works Progress Administration, helped with a lot of infrastructure and art projects. Of course, then you had the Social Security Act of 1935, which basically started the welfare system in the U.S. And then you had the FDIC, which was also a problem, or has become a problem, and that protected bank deposits. It was great for back then because the banks were failing. And people basically had lost everything. Which brings us to the subject for today. Penny auctions. Now, if you Google penny auctions, you'll come up with the new version of it now. But penny auctions in the 1930s were a lot different. So during the Great Depression, and this happened, like I said, in the 30s, they were a grassroots protest event organized by farmers. Real-life acts of community resistance against farm foreclosures. So when the Depression hit, and you had all the lost savings and everybody failing, farmers couldn't make their mortgage or their tax payments. And banks started foreclosing and selling them at public auctions to hopefully recover their debts. And the sales basically meant that families lost their land and their livelihoods. So there wasn't a movement. Some people claim it started in Nebraska. Some people claim it started. But local farmers organized to protect one another. So when a bank auctioned off a foreclosed farm, hundreds of neighbors would show up and intimidate outside bidders, intimidate the bankers. Sometimes just by the sheer presence of that many farmers in one place. Sometimes it was a little more direct. If you look up some of the pictures, I think I looked at a couple out of Michigan. People would put hangman's nooses up in the barn doors to warn people that outside bidding and upping the bidding was not welcome. If an outsider tried to bid, the crowd would pressure or scare that individual off. So only a few cents, usually just a penny, was what would be offered for the property, the equipment, the animals. So the sheriff would start the auction, And the crowd of farmers already had it figured out that nobody would bid, at most, more than a few pennies. And a neighbor or a friend would, quote-unquote, win the auction for the pennies and then return the property to the original owner after the auction. So these auctions were a form of protest against what a lot of people saw as unfair banking practices. They demonstrated rural solidarity and community resistance to bank foreclosures. In some regions, the movement helped pressure government to pass farm relief laws, like the Fraser-Lemke Farm Bankruptcy Act of 1934, which offered struggling farmers more time to repay their debts. These penny auctions were really common in Iowa, Nebraska, Minnesota, Wisconsin, Kansas, and Michigan. So Iowa was one of the harder hit farming states during the Great Depression. Corn prices had essentially bottomed out. Literally, you were basically growing it for nothing. And thousands, like I said, of farmers faced foreclosure. Banks wanted to get them auctioned off, and local communities organized. So the message to the banks and authorities was clear. We will not let our neighbors lose their farms to the Depression. And these were nonviolent, forceful, and largely community organized type of economic civil disobedience. So in some states, especially Iowa, these penny auctions became so frequent that sheriffs began refusing to carry out foreclosures for fear of violence or embarrassment. And over time, these acts, like the Farm Bankruptcy Act and higher crop prices, helped stabilize rural America. So the penny auctions from the 30s weren't just local protests. They reflected the economic desperation of the Great Depression, the power of community cooperation, and the early roots of organized resistance that influenced later social movements. So how did they get the message out that outsiders weren't welcome at these foreclosure auctions? One, word of mouth. News of pending foreclosures would go through the local farm networks like church meetings, general stores, rural mail routes, farmer unions like the Farmers Holiday Association. They put out no flyers, no written notices that would draw police or bank attention. And everybody understood to show up, bid low, and protect the farm. So when the auction would begin, the message was obviously very visual and immediate. Farmers sometimes stood shoulder to shoulder, forming a silent wall around the auction area. And the message usually was received that this is a community matter. Outsiders had better not interfere. If a stranger or a bank representative tried to bid, somebody would calmly but firmly say things like, you don't want to make that bid, or this farm belongs to the community. And the tone would typically get through that the bid would lead to trouble. And the goal was to discourage interference without needing confrontation. Sometimes a designated spokesperson, typically a respected older farmer in the community, would address the sheriff or outsiders on behalf of the farmer group. Now, within the community, everybody knew the unspoken rules. Only one trusted bidder would offer a token bid. Nobody else would challenge it. And after the sale, the property was returned to the original family. Breaking that code meant betraying the community. So word of these auctions spread through local newspapers and gossip, and the consistency of these events across the states made penny auctions that symbolic protest movement. Little history that probably hardly anybody remembers or realizes. So there we go. Any thoughts, any comments?
Oh, and we pretend like farmers are all just a bunch of law-abiding conservatives. If that's not organized left-wing labor right there, I don't know what is. What is. It's great. I love those stories, even though it was illegal and all this kind of stuff. It's like, it just proves the point. We live in it's kind of like a video game, right? And organized power is a big deal. And so why should one side be able to organize without the other? You get something out of whack, out of balance when that's the case. So I don't know. Illegal or not, I love that. I love it.
It wasn't illegal. I mean, it was a legal farm auction. They bid on the property. They purchased it, maybe for a penny. But they bought it at a legal farm foreclosure auction. How the property got back to the original owner, that's a whole different story. But
well, I mean, I'm sure some were legal. I'm just saying there was some that, you know.
You went in the matrix, Jeremy.
I mean, there was somewhere there was like, oh, shoot. How about now?
Yep, that's better. Fine.
Any better? Okay. I was just saying, I remember reading a bunch of, there's a lot of literature out there that includes things about these penny auctions. And, I mean, there was some, you know, there'd be nooses hanging in the barn behind the auctioneer. And things like that. So when I say illegal, I mean, yeah, not all of them were, but, you know, intimidating people out of allowing the bank to, you know, get fair market value for their debt is illegal. But the point is, it's not like, I mean, so you're transgressing against a bank. It's like it's only illegal because, you know, anyway. That's what I was getting at. There's some stories out there. I mean, there's a great body of wood. Like, they became very famous. It's a huge movement of protests, like you were saying. And there's lots written about them. And, you know, the consequences of them are pretty widespread.
Yeah. Yeah. I love it that some sheriffs got the message that even just trying to foreclose on some of these farms was not a good idea. Mark?
No, I was going to ask if you could send me that article, Shannon. I'm actually wondering whether us farmers can't use something similar under the current underpaid environment that we're in. I'm not too sure how, but there's something in that, I'm sure, for all of us.
Well, it wasn't an article. I actually put it together. So it was more a presentation. I'll figure out a way to get it to you.
No, that's all right. I'll just Google it. I just wanted to understand how it works. So I'll just Google it. No worries. Thank you.
I heard it on a video, and I was like, ooh, I got to look this up. And then once I looked it up, I'm like, yeah, we're going to talk about that on Saturday. So
yes, Jeremy,
I spent a little time.
I was going to say that, Jeremy, I could be going far left. Okay.
That is true.
Yeah, yeah. These categories are becoming far, far less useful, or almost not useful as far as I'm concerned. I can't remember what I was going to say about these auctions. Sorry.
Now, if you think of it, bring it back.
I always think of the political spectrum as like a pendulum, that we need both sides from time to time. And you can see even recently, like, you know, in your case, some of the Democrats have gone to the other side just so that they can get their own way, so they can have a platform to speak on. So I think RFK was his whole Kennedy family was a Democrat, and he's flung over to the Republicans. So I believe that's what our political spectrum is for, so that when things get out of whack, we can swing to the other side, and then probably gets out of whack again after 4 years, and we have to go back the other way. So that's how I sort of view the political spectrum.
Good point.
Oh, I remember what I was going to say. Shannon, was there something in there about, like, maybe, did you have something about, like, okay, are we going to have something similar to this?
I didn't, but that is a good point.
Because I think there was a little bit of that happened in the 80s, I remember.
Yeah.
But it just was less effective there's all kinds of reasons. Like today, I mean, even just equipment auctions have been ruined by the internet, as far as I'm concerned.
Yep.
Not for the dealers, not for the bankers, not for that class of people, but for a farmer who just wants to maybe get a good deal at an auction, like those days are kind of over. I mean, there's still some of those auctions, but not really, because you can bid online, there's proxy bids, like all this kind of junk has just ruined it. And so I think that is definitely takes some of this out of the equation moving forward. But also, frankly, I don't think people have the cojones like they used to. Like, I don't think we understand how much was on the line for those people and how different that is today with, like, safety nets and everything else, you know, mm-hmm. that we have, like, in the, like, it didn't really exist in the 40s. I mean, some of this was, as far as I understand it, was the impetus for some of these safety nets to even come up in the first place. They said, if we don't have a safety net, look at what these farmers are going to do. We can't have a civil society with, you know, vigilante justice in the flyover states. And so part of those programs are literally avoiding this.
Yeah. To protect the bankers, to protect the companies, and yeah. Yep. Anybody else? Alrighty. Jeremy, you want anything else, or I know you got on the phone there.
No. No, you should circle back on this one, though, because anyway, or I will, but
okay.
Go ahead. No,
yeah,
not today, but there's a good point to be made here. I'm not exactly sure what it is, but there's some more points. For sure.
It'll probably come to you in the middle of the night when you're getting ready to go in the house. Just make sure you remember it.
I do have a question real quick.
Yes.
About this. So in back in those days, were there like farmer associations that, you know, sort of either by written agreement or it was understood that, there was a certain structure associated with, you know, being a farmer in a particular area and kind of protocols to protect one another?
No, it was more communities. Now, remember that we had a lot more farmers and ranchers here in the U.S. than we do now. So there was a lot more community. There was a lot more people to come together and protect the community. So it wasn't necessarily the association. There was one day, which kind of led the whole thing once the penny auctions kind of started gaining some steam. Some of the other ones in other parts of the country were the United Farmers League, Southern Tenant Farmers Union. I just looked these up really quick, so don't think I'm going from memory here by any means. But not very many. Most of it was community organized, community spread from farmer to farmer to farmer. It just kind of gained steam that was how they were going to protect themselves from these bankers and in some cases in the 30s, some unscrupulous banking practices, which had put some of these farmers in pretty bad positions. So, which is, to Jeremy's point, led to some laws that protected some more of the bankers. But, yeah, because they lost a whole lot of money in that whole thing. But not that anybody really feels sorry for the bankers by any means. So I don't know if that answered your question completely, but that's kind of the way it was.
Yeah, that's fine. Yeah, it is what it is, right?
I mean, we have a lot more farmer organizations now that lobby and do a lot of things. Some not so good, in my opinion, but yeah, we have a lot more now than we did then. But we're 90-some years on from that time. So, anybody else? Thoughts? Comments?
Yes, I want to say something because Jeremy said something that that's probably what my parents live in the 30s, probably for them were primitive times. In which they didn't have banking, but their word was their bank. They respect their word, whatever they promised to do. They did business between them, just by a shake hands. And respect their word. Whatever they promise to pay back, they will do it. And everybody was making sure that if they probably invest their money, they will succeed. That's how I can put it today, in the way that they were able to do business. So I guess that whatever, yes, they did have cojones, that's what I said. And yes, but the other thing is the word is, you know, that was very good cook, and he used to have the cojones and have them at... barbecue them and just a pure coals, and that was a trip that we have every time that he did, could have one. So it's things that I just would like to, because this is my perception of the culture, the agriculture that I have the blessing of be part of it in my early, very early life, part of life, because it didn't last too long. But thank you so much that bringing that, because probably in the 30s that was my grandparents and great grandparents. Mm-hmm. That lived that a close culture, then it was one family. The town was just one family, then that was it. But thank you so much for bringing that. I appreciate it. And know, and see that it existed in other parts of the world, in a small communities that supported each other. And the thing, it was they invest their money, but they were mature that these people will prosper, succeed, so they could, you know, everybody benefit from that. So thank you so much.
Yep. You're welcome. All righty. Anybody else? All righty. So companies that reach a century of doing business are pretty uncommon. Some experts estimate that only 0.5% of companies actually make it to a century. Caterpillar joins that group here in 2025, joining companies like Coca-Cola, John Deere, Harley-Davidson, UPS, and several others. Now, Caterpillar, as we know it today, started with two small California companies. So the Holt brothers, started in 1892 in San Francisco selling lumber and iron. January 11th of 1892, papers were filed to incorporate the Holt Manufacturing Company with the three Holt brothers and two of their friends. And so they had a subsidiary business called the Stockton Wheel Company to build wheels for them. And that first year, they produced 6,000 wagon wheels and 5,000 carriage bodies. Well, two of the brothers brought out the third one after a few years. And one focused on operations, the other focused on manufacturing. And in the late 1800s and early 1900s, steam-powered farm machinery was rapidly replacing horse-drawn equipment. And these brothers capitalized on that trend by converting horse-drawn combines to run on steam. By the early 20th century, Holt Manufacturing Company was the leading manufacturer of combine harvesters in the U.S. and the leading California-based manufacturer of steam traction engines. So one of the brothers saw a need for technological advancements in farm machinery and pushed Holt into the farm equipment business. They produced a horse-drawn link belt combine harvester in 1883, which allowed cutting and threshing grain to be completed in a single mechanical operation. And that increased farmers' productivity and cut labor in half. So the first one came to full market in 1886. It required 18 horses to pull it. The largest combine it would go on to manufacture had a 50-foot long cutting bar and took 40 horses to pull. The widest combine head available to the big equipment we have today is around 60 feet. So it really was not much smaller than what we're currently using today. And it's larger than the average farmer uses, which is about 40-foot heads on their combines. So these guys were well ahead of their time. But as steam power became more popular, they experimented with a steam tractor they called Old Betsy. 24-foot long, had 60 horsepower from a single cylinder engine, and would burn wood, coal, or oil. You had to fill it with 675 gallons of water. It weighed 48,000 pounds, or 24 tons, and probably compacted the ground something. It probably compacted a lot of the ground, we'll just say that. Farmers and loggers loved the tractors for the relative efficiency, but the weight did become a problem. So to combat the sinking of some of these things into the ground, they expanded the size and width of the wheels, but that brought its own complexities and difficulties to maintain. So the one brother ended up developing a workable track laying system, replacing the wheels on a 40 horsepower Colt steamer with a set of wooden tracks bolted to chains. And the test was successful on this new design on Thanksgiving Day in 1904. So one photographer recorded the event and claimed that it looked like a caterpillar going through the field. The name stuck. The brothers started producing track tractors under the Caterpillar name, which they trademarked in 1911. Their first production model was a dual track frame, 30 inches high by 42 inches wide by 9 feet long, and sold for a king's ransom of $5,500. Over the next decade, they had more than 2,000 of these Caterpillar crawlers sold in more than 20 countries. With a desire to grow their ag business, their eyes fell to the Midwest. And they saw companies like John Deere here. So there was a factory in East Peoria, Illinois, which was recently built and was available. So they bought it in 1909. The Holt Caterpillar Company was incorporated on January 12, 1910 in California and Illinois. Started production in both states And by 1912, the Illinois facility employed 625 people and exported tractors across North and South America. Bring in the other half of this country. Best manufacturing company in Stockton, California. They were bought out by Holtz in 1908 in an effort to resolve a patent infringement lawsuit. Well, in 1910, he formed his own company, Clarence Best. Named it after himself, the C.L. Best Traction Company. So he designed a tractor-style tractor in the early 1910s. And his track layer design was nearly an exact copy of the Holtz crawler. And had a conventional wheel on the front, used two setter and crawling wheels on the back. His most popular was a 60-horse tractor or crawler, produced starting in 1919. Powered by a four-cylinder overhead valve gasoline engine with 60 horse at the belt and 35 horse at the drawbar. It only weighed 20,500 pounds. These two merged in 1925, creating Caterpillar. And Mr. Best tractor was renamed the Caterpillar 60. And during its 12 years of production, there was 18,938 units produced. Bring in World War I. That changed the U.S. manufacturing landscape as a lot of factories transitioned to supply machinery for the military. Holtz tractors were widely used as artillery tractors during the war. And that experience working with the government led him to a plan of expansion to meet the needs of the armed forces. So C.L. Best Company did not supply tractors for the war effort. They focused on providing smaller tractors for farmers with assurance from the government that they would be able to obtain the needed steel during the war to continue to make ag machines. And this gave Best an advantage in the ag market over Holt when World War I ended. Now, both companies faced challenges in transitioning out of wartime production. And both were in very financial difficulties in 1925. So they merged, became the Caterpillar Tractor Company, and under terms of the merger, the company's headquarters were moved from California to Peoria, Illinois in 1930. Now, they offered just five track-type tractors at first. The 2-ton, the 5-ton, the 10-ton from Holtz production line, and the Caterpillar 30 and the Caterpillar 60 from C.L. Best line. And the company's completely new tractor was built in 1929 called the Caterpillar L20. And now Caterpillar is one of the dominant companies in the world. Any thoughts, any comments? I think Mark ought to get one of those 1920s tractors so that he can really go back in time here.
What you mean, go back to a very compacted soil?
Was that considered commercial even back then?
No, it was considered agricultural. Nope. It's kind of fun. I'm just having fun today, sharing some.
No, I love it. Go ahead.
Education.
Okay, that caterpillar become a monarch butterfly.
What? No. 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 No.
Shannon's a butterfly?
No, I'm not a butterfly. You should know better than that, Pat. Far from a butterfly, trust me.
Or okay, yes, monarch. Take off the butterfly.
I'm far from a monarch, too. Trust me, I'm not that good looking.
Is it a moth? Is a monarch a moth or a butterfly?
It's a butterfly.
Have you ever been to one of the preserves? We have one about 10 minutes from where I live at Pismo Beach. Is one of the biggest locations. I believe it's like number one in the United States, where they come from Mexico. It's absolutely fabulous to see them hanging in swarms. I shouldn't use the word swarms, but in clusters, right? They are swarming at points, but hanging in clusters, it's indescribable. It's the most beautiful thing ever. That's all I can say. Nella came up too. I'm not sure.
Yep. Any other thoughts on the Caterpillar company?
About Caterpillar, but I'm going to give you a hard time for not mentioning my favorite company, which is over 200 years old.
Which one's that?
Stark Brothers, my plant addiction. Oh. The people that give me my plant fix.
That's true.
They're over 200 years old.
Nella has a plant addiction, so just so you're wondering where that's coming from. One of her favorite companies is Stark Brothers. They're out of Eastern Missouri, just north of St. Louis. They've been providing plants all throughout the U.S. for over 200 years.
Since 1816.
So,
Shannon, get it right or let Nella tell the story.
It's more fun for me to butcher it, and then I get reprimanded, Pat.
But I don't know any other company that's in the U.S. that's been in business for over 200 years.
I would have to look that up. I'm not sure. Anybody else? Let's see. I'm going to have to look it up now. So, some of the companies that we know here in the U.S. that are over 200 years old. Had to kick this into Google really quick. So, Caswell Massey, they were founded in 1752, probably when the Pilgrims got here. But they're the oldest personal care and fragrance company in the U.S. Baker's Chocolate was established in 1765. Jim Beam, if you like that beverage, was founded in 1795. And King Arthur Baking Company, they started in 1790. So they've been around a long time. Now, if we go to the manufacturing side of things, none of us like chemicals. But DuPont has been around since 1802. That's just some of the ones that I brought up that would have ties to agriculture. So, plus Stark Brothers, which did start in 1816. So I don't get myself in too much more trouble here. Let's see, some of the other ones. We might actually have to do a room on older companies because this wouldn't take a while to unpack. But anyway, there you go. Quick search. So they've got a pretty proud history, we'll say. That's a good question, Soma. I have no clue how Baker's made chocolate back in the 1700s. Sounds like homework to me. And then you can bring it back to the group. All righty. Let's go out or over to the University of Illinois. So we talk a lot about emissions, and Mark always brings up the fact that airplanes haven't stopped flying, and we've got a lot more of them in the air putting emissions there. And people obviously, for the most part, want faster transportation. So jet fuel is one of those subjects that has come up in a lot more conversations. Well, the University of Illinois at Champaign have discovered a novel way to address the problem by converting food waste into sustainable aviation fuel that meets industry standards without relying on fossil fuel blends. So the process is this in a nutshell. The researchers convert food waste into bio-crude oil through a thermochemical conversion process called hydrothermal liquefaction, or HTL. They remove the impurities, and they refine it with the use of hydrogen and catalyst to turn it into aviation fuel. Now, this approach can be applied to a variety of feedstocks and types of oil, which could be a brand new direction for obtaining fuels. So according to the lead researcher, HTL basically mimics the natural formation of crude oil in the earth. It uses high heat and pressure to convert wet biomass into the bio-crude oil. The goal of this work is to upgrade that oil into transportation fuels that can go directly into existing energy infrastructure. In this project, the researchers used waste from a nearby food processing facility. And globally, over 30% of food is wasted annually at all levels of the supply chain. I think some people even put that estimate even higher. So farm decomposition in landfills and wastewater treatment plants further contributes to greenhouse gas emissions, and recycling waste helps promote sustainability. So the researchers say that HTL can process feedstock from a wide range of biowaste, including food, sewage sludge, algae bloom, pig manure, and ag residue. So one of the professors said, to meet the aviation industry's goal to decarbonate jet fuel, we're going to need different renewable sources, and agriculture is going to play a critical role in terms of providing the feedstocks. So to convert the oil into jet fuel, the researchers remove the impurities like moisture, ash, and salt, then use a process called catalytic hydrotreating to eliminate unwanted elements like nitrogen, oxygen, and sulfur. That leaves behind only the hydrocarbons needed for fuel. After testing dozens of options, they identified cobalt molybdenum as the most effective commercially available catalyst to drive the necessary chemical reactions and refine the oil into sustainable aviation fuel. So to optimize the hydrotreatment process, the researchers adjusted variables like temperature, catalyst, and hydrogen loads, and retention time to identify the best conditions for producing jet fuel. They then tested the fuel against rigorous standards set by the FAA and the American Society for Testing of Materials. Their SAF sample passed tier alpha and beta pre-screening tests and met all specifications for conventional jet fuel without requiring any additives or blending with fossil fuels. The technology has the potential to be scaled up for commercial production, according to the lead researcher, saying our research helps solve the science and engineering problems. The industry can now step in. The process can be applied to other types of oils for SAF. It can also replace other materials like petroleum-derived compounds for making plastics, which has huge potential for business opportunities and economic development. So this research team developed an index to measure circular bioeconomy and said SAF provides a valuable contribution to the circular economy. So right now, we pretty much live in a linear economy. We produce something, we use it, we throw it away. In this project, they're taking things that most people consider waste, recover the energy and materials to make a usable product, and that fills a link in the circular paradigm. So the paper is called From Food Waste to Sustainable Aviation Fuel, Cobalt Molybdenum Catalyst of Pretreated Hydrothermal Liquefaction Biocrude. Yeah, don't make me say that one again. Any thoughts, any comments? Really, the only one I have is I want the car from Back to the Future if we're going to run on food waste. That's all I have to say. But anyway, thoughts, comments?
That was a DeLorean, right?
Yep.
Kind of reminds you of this Tesla truck, kind of.
The DeLorean looked a lot better than that damn Tesla truck. Oh. Anybody else? All righty. So a court case that we had mentioned, we've kind of been following it a little bit off and on, was the corner crossing case out in the West. So the Supreme Court has refused to hear the case, which means that it goes back to the lower court's decision. This leaves a lot of Western property owners in limbo over federal land access. So if you remember this past March, we talked about the 10th Circuit Court of Appeals upholding the, upholding the right to access federal lands in a corner crossing fashion, as long as a private property owner's land is not physically touched. Well, now due to the Supreme Court's deciding not to hear the case, that leaves a lot of property owners not in a very good position. Everybody was hopeful that the Supreme Court would settle this once and for all. So what this started was a couple Missouri hunters brought this up out of Wyoming. When they were trying to cross into some federal land where it came into conjunction with private property. And the hunters had used handheld GPS to locate a section corner on a ranch. And then they used a stepladder to cross over from one parcel of the BLM's land to another. So it was at a checkerboard corner, essentially, with privately owned land. Now, the men claimed they camped and hunted only on BLM land. However, they were arrested for criminal trespass by Wyoming law enforcement. A local jury acquitted the four hunters of the charges. However, the ranch owner subsequently sued the hunters on civil charges, alleging $9 million in damages tied to the diminished value of his property. He claimed the hunters trespassed when they entered private airspace over the quote-unquote corner point where the properties interacted. The case again went against him as the chief U.S. District Court judge ruled in front of the hunters. Upon appeal, the 10th Circuit agreed with the district judge, once again rejecting the ranchers' trespass claims. So the hunters' legal arguments were based on the Range War era 1885 U.S. Unlawful Enclosures Act, which prohibits blocking access to government land, including by fencing and using threats and intimidation. So, upon refusing to hear the case, the U.S. Supreme Court leaves the 10th Circuit's ruling in place. That makes corner crossing lawful within its jurisdictional states of the 10th Circuit, which is Wyoming, Colorado, Utah, New Mexico, Kansas, and Oklahoma. Everywhere else, policymakers and law enforcement are fending for themselves. Now, with the 9th Circuit Court, there's 900,000 acres of corner-locked government-owned lands. Montana's Fish, Wildlife, and Park Department has stated that corner crossing remains unlawful in Montana. Game wardens will continue to refer corner crossing cases to county attorneys, who then decide whether to prosecute. The Montana Stock Guards Association said corner crossing is a serious threat to the integrity of private land ownership. We have a long history of advocating for clear, consistent laws that uphold the rights of landowners while supporting access solutions that respect both public and private interests. So in Wyoming, which is just south of Montana, the legality of corner crossing is clear. Anybody can cross the checkerboard corners as long as they do not touch private land or do any damage while crossing. Now, where this kind of becomes a gray area. Fences and fence corners may not exactly line up in the legal pinpoints. And there's already some confusion with hunting season in full swing. Law enforcement's getting calls from stock growers about suspected trespasses where legal corners and fence corners don't exactly match. A lot of these fences were built long before technology that we have today, like GPS and things like that. Sometimes in the mountains, you put the fence where you can put the fence because it's a little difficult to put it probably on the lines. The other problem that is becoming readily apparent is as the growing population seeks out places to go for recreation and roam, and more tools and toys to do that with drones and off-road vehicles and electric bikes and all that stuff, there's probably going to be more scenarios where people trying to gain access to federal land by having to try to navigate these corner crossings, these checkerboard crossings, are going to end up on private property, and it probably is going to get uglier since the Supreme Court decided not to make this decide on what the law of the land is. So, could get interesting, folks, but that's what it is in Wyoming in the 10th District. So I guess we'll find out. Any thoughts, any comments? All righty. Making this easy on me tonight for the most part. So typically when we talk about probiotics, most people probably think about human probiotics. However, probiotic applications for beef cattle are research-backed, and it's starting to gain traction in beef systems, offering new tools for rumen stability and health management. So even though we're seeing record beef prices, and we are seeing farmers make a ton of money, or were up until Trump opened his mouth and the prices got hammered, every gain in efficiency matters. Stabilizing feed intake, supporting growth through stress events, and improving animal health overall. Probiotics offer a way to facilitate this efficiency through fine-tuned rumen and gut health. So probiotics are defined as live microorganisms that confer a health benefit when fed in adequate amounts. This is nothing new to the feed industry. Recent studies, though, in both grazing and finishing systems have clarified when and how they can deliver measurable results. So rather than just blanket use, probiotics in beef systems are becoming more effective when used strategically during transitions, stress, or high energy feeding phases. So think weaning, birth, things like that. Probiotics used in beef production most often include yeast, spore-forming bacteria, and occasionally lactic acid bacteria. And their effects center on three main functions. The rumen stabilization, where yeast cultures help moderate rumen pH, especially in high-grain diets, promoting fiber-digesting bacterial populations. Digestive efficiency. Bacillus strains produce enzymes that enhance starch and fiber breakdown, improving feed conversion. And then third, immune and stress modulation. Some probiotics appear to blunt cortisol response during transport or feedlot induction, supporting intake and weight recovery after arrival. Some newer research out has also linked probiotic use with lower pathogen shedding, which creates potential food safety benefits for our feedlots and carries on through the packers. If everybody remembers here, what, 3 weeks ago or so, we talked about the bacterial load on pork, which increases at the packer sites. So, I mean, this probiotics carries over to all the livestock species, but we're just talking about beef here in this one. So for cow-calf systems, probiotics are primarily evaluated for calf vigor, weaning transition, and heifer development. So they use the best cattle available, which are a group of Red Angus cows. They offered a live yeast supplement from 30 days pre-calving through weaning.
Boy, it's too bad that's the only cattle they had.
Just seeing if you're awake, sir. So these cows showed improved body condition scores at weaning, and their calves had higher weaning weights and average daily gains. The growth-promoting effects of yeast supplementation to calves pre-weaning was highly dependent on the strain of probiotics or bacteria. But what has been consistently shown is a reduction in diarrhea or scours and pneumonia incidents. So probiotic supplementation has also been linked to reduced stress responses. In a behavioral study that was done with beef heifers, and they didn't mention the breed here, probably Red Angus because they're the best, probiotic supplementation showed fewer signs of distress during shoot handling through serum cortisol levels, or those serum cortisol levels were unaffected. In feedlot cattle, yeast supplementation could help mitigate the negative effect of heat stress when offered in preparation for exposure to increased temperatures. Finishing feedlot cattle are often fed high concentrate diets for extended periods of time, which has the potential to make rumen health maintenance imperative. Probiotics are a logical avenue for this maintenance. Cattle fed high concentrate diets have been shown to benefit from a yeast enterococcus probiotic mix, affecting rumen digestion, resulting in improved average daily gain and feed efficiency. Probiotic supplementation has also been shown to help high-risk cattle. Steers fed a bacillus-based probiotic through a 3-month grazing period did not show a reduced incidence of bovine respiratory disease. The animals, though, did have reduced rates of mortality and removal compared to the control animals. So, let's see, we kind of already went through that. So, actionable takeaways. Consider the herd specifically. Probiotics are not a one-size-fits-all solution for beef cattle. Different microbes serve different purposes and should be matched for your production challenges and your goals. Integrate probiotics into herd health protocols, not just nutrition plans. Probiotics can complement disease reduction efforts through rumen health support. Number 3, document outcomes over multiple lots. Track animal performance and health over consecutive groups to give yourself an idea whether observed benefits are repeatable. And number 4, leverage fecal scoring or manure scoring and rumen pH monitoring as diagnostic tools. Pairing probiotic use with routine rumen fluid or fecal consistency evaluation can offer early indications of effectiveness. Brian, any thoughts on probiotics there? I'll give you first shot at it if you want to.
I don't know if I have a signal here, but probiotics is something that we use as a part of our mineral supplement. They're added in there already because they are a vital part of that healthy rumen of that animal. So yeah, this is something we're already using, I guess, to make a long story short, and it's been beneficial for us to use the probiotics and keep the animals healthy. So that's what I got, I guess. The biggest thing is yeah, you really got to watch that manure and make sure that they don't have an upset gut, specifically here during stressful times when they're getting weaned or during weather events, to make sure that they stay healthy and keep growing well. Because a little, it's just, oh, I don't know whether you want to call it the time fallacy. Like, if you go back in time and you kill one fly, it might make a big change later on. Well, a little change or a little hiccup when they first start in the feedlot can cause them to lose feed efficiency, to not be as healthy, to not be as good all the way throughout the rest of their life. So you want to set them up for a good, healthy, productive life, whether they're going back into the herd or going onto the dinner plate. It all starts with keeping that gut health and keeping them going balance-wise. So I guess that's what I got. A little distracted here trying to get stuff ready to go for next busy week, bringing in about 400 head of cattle.
So one quick question, Brian, is how long ago did you guys implement probiotics into your mineral program to really start seeing the benefits of that?
About 14 years ago, we started using probiotics. They've kind of come into favor more now. Yeast is a big thing, but we've went through a bunch of research trials on a bunch of different probiotics, and it depends on where your cattle are at. Some of them are worth the extra money, but the biggest thing is if you can keep the diet there right, it doesn't make a big difference in long term. But yeah, it is having the probiotics to encourage the good, natural, healthy functioning of that animal way outweighs anything you can do with the rest of feeds or medicines or whatever. So you are what you eat is the moral of the story. And it applies to cattle just like it applies to humans.
Awesome. Thank you, sir. I appreciate that. I've been saving that one for either you or Kyle to be in here. So
yeah. Yeah. When you're a BTO and trying to harvest 500 acres of corn that you still ain't got done yet, it takes time.
It does. It does. I saved it. I waited. Anybody else on questions?
Hi there. Yes. Shannon, I'm a true believer in the use of natural products to enhance the health of ruminants. In 2006, before this technology was sexy, in Europe, they banned the use of antibiotics in animals because of the obvious reason that we humans would be eating their antibiotics. So I was part of a academic stroke business consortium, which I'm not sure why Brian's doing the X sign.
Antibiotics better treat, when you treat animals with antibiotics, they do not stay in the meat. So that is a false equivalence.
Okay, let me finish what I'm saying and then comment afterwards. Thank you, Brian.
Yep, hold on. Yep, let's
okay.
Okay, go ahead.
I don't talk very often, so
Yep. No, you're good.
This is one of my expert subjects as I only come up when I know something very well. I'm an inventor scientist in the UK, Wales. Wales, as you know, is a land of sheep.
Sure.
Agricultural innovations I've been involved with since 2005. I'm a serial inventor. One of the inventions that I invented was the use of a natural product, botanical based, that can be an alternative to antibiotics, synthetic antibiotics and common antibiotics, because antibiotics have been prescribed too much by doctors and you're seeing antibiotic resistance throughout. So if we can come up with natural alternatives, then it's a win-win for everyone. So I come up with we screen 2,500 plants. I supplied 10 plants. Some big pharmaceutical companies supplied about 2,000 plants, and there's only about 9 of us in a consortium. And out of those 2,500 plants, mine came out the best. I was the only one that could be patented. The one who came second best actually became the most famous in one of the most famous in Europe. They're called Mutra. They attracted about $100 million in investment since 2019. And now they've gone out of business. Not because that their technology didn't work, but I think they overspent. They grew too rapidly. They took on too much staff, et cetera, et cetera. But cut the long story short, the use of natural products, well, plants, you can't stop your ruminants eating plants. And these plants have got antibiotic, natural antibiotic properties. The one that I invented and the ones that it was tested for was to see if we could mitigate E. coli and Listeria. That was the first screening. And look at the effect on protozoa, the effect on pH, the effect on volatile fatty acids, and more importantly, which it was like an afterthought, the effect on methane gas emissions. And Brian mentioned the use of yeast. Yeast is quite commonly used as an animal feed additive to mitigate methane gas, and so is oat porridge. So I'm a chemist, by the way. I'm not even a biologist, but I'm surrounded by biologists and I learn a lot of biology. And I believe the only way we can move forward in life is by getting collaborations between biologists and chemists, you know? Nobody can work alone, so collaborations is the way forward. But my invention was discovered in 2006. The world wasn't ready for it. The world was only ready for this kind of technology around 2016, 17, 18. And it's only now that I'm gaining commercial interest from the Pacific areas like Australia and New Zealand. So everything's got its time and place, but I'm a firm believer in the use of botanicals to mitigate diseases or, you know, that is potent to animals. I hope that's useful. Thank you.
No, thank you. I appreciate that. And I think what Brian was getting to is, you know, here in the U.S. especially, we have the withdrawal periods on antibiotics, so it doesn't end up in our meat supply. I think that was what he was more getting to on that point. So we're very careful. And if you get caught not adhering to those withdrawal periods, you get in a whole heap and lot of trouble. So I think that's where he was going with that.
Yeah. In 2006, the ban came into place.
Yep.
Did that ban come into place in the USA?
No. So we can use antibiotics, but then in, what was it, 2018, I think it was, we got limited as far as producers being able to purchase antibiotics whenever they wanted to actually having to go to a vet and get a prescription, just like we would to a doctor. And then what was it, 2022, I think they added the second phase to that, which essentially made anything that is in that realm, I can't remember all the details off the head, but everything has to have a veterinarian's prescription for that. So Brian can't just go to the local feed store and buy any antibiotic he wants now. He has to have that veterinary patient relationship, and that veterinarian will write him a prescription, and he can get the medicine he needs to treat the animals that he needs to treat. Now, to your point, and one of those things is, sorry, I'm just looking back at the chat here. You know, farmers sometimes, especially for worms, have used tobacco in the past to feed animals as a natural dewormer. So there's been natural products on the market, but I think a lot of it was, in my mind, kind of forgotten when these big companies started offering synthetics that were easier to use and quicker. And it just led us down this path to where we are now. As we look, hopefully, to the future, as people start asking more questions and they're looking for that transparency in their food system, we as producers obviously have to answer that call, but we also have to educate that antibiotics in and of themselves are not bad. It's the misuse of them that causes the problems. There is a use for them. There is a call for them. It is a good tool in the toolbox to have when we need it. Now, I'm always for the phrase, an ounce of prevention is worth a pound of cure. You know, if I can do something ahead of time to hopefully cut off anything that might require the use of antibiotics, then we're money ahead. But we have to be very careful in these conversations in agriculture to ensure that we don't take out tools that we possibly could need in our operations. I'm all for adding tools to the toolbox. I just want to be careful we don't take tools out of the toolbox that definitely come in handy when they're needed. So, but no, I appreciate you bringing that up. That was good information. So, any other thoughts, comments, questions? And Brian, you can correct me on any of those dates or anything that I maybe misspoke on that antibiotic and veterinary patient thing. I think I was pretty close, but
actually, yeah. Shannon,
go ahead, Brian.
I'll just say, yeah, you're pretty close, and I gave you the X because antibiotics used in livestock are not just classical or blanket classified as bad, and there are some European countries that have labeled it as such to be a protectionist against their production methods and the Americans. So that's why I gave you the red X, because the way you said it, it could be interpreted that way. And that's why I said what I said.
Yep. Nope. I appreciate that. So Mark.
I was going to say, you know, the use of plants as a probiotic has been around for a long time. My father used garlic actually as a as an antibiotic actually. So both we can use plants for, but he used garlic as an antibiotic for the cows. I don't like to talk about cows, as you know. But Don Huber is my number one favorite scientist at the moment, and he brings up that each year we put on 330,000 pounds of an antibiotic called Roundup on our feed, and the cows have that, and that can actually knock out some of the good bugs in our stomach as well as the some of the cattle or other animals. So I don't think that is, you know, fully recognized. I just want to share that possibility because glyphosate is registered as an antibiotic. So I just wanted to point that out.
Yeah, glyphosate gets registered as a lot of things, Mark. And you'll be proud of your Kiwi neighbors there here in a minute if we get to the article. So all righty. Anybody else?
Yes. I would like to say something about that. You said that it's good to make sure that no tools are taken out of the box, and I agree because you used it. But what I said is that it should add into an option for the ones who wants to use the other. Because it's not let in the same, even for us, medicines, we paid insurance, we paid all these things, and we have no options of natural medicine. So natural products. So what it lets us is just one choice, yeah, and we're forced to do that. And then we are forced to buy those natural products outside. So that goes for that. It's an option added. Yes, let whatever people, but they give us, the rest of us, a choice to choose. Thank you.
Thank you. Anybody else?
Maybe I missed part of that, but are you talking like beef or meat or produce that's made with those options, or are you talking about human health care? I don't know if I missed something.
Okay. Yes, I missed the two things. I'm sorry, Brian. I need to be more clear. Yes. We if we want to have products that contain those healthy bacteria, whatever is in the animals or whatever is in the products of the animals, then we have to pay a little more than that, because the budget, the majority of people cannot afford them. And the same goes for the medical supplies. You know, if we choose a outside of what is forcing to us or is available to us, we are left from those good choices, because there's no way to choose that without having to pay it out of my pocket. Thank you.
Yeah, the reason I wanted to ask for sure is because your ability to choose should not mandate my ability to produce. And if people don't want to produce stuff that I'm feeding and treat with antibiotics when necessary, they have the right not to do that, but they're going to have to pay more for not having any antibiotics used ever, because the production costs are higher, because you do have more death loss, or else they have to go out of that system. So all the time you spent feeding them in a way that was the production method that's preferred by somebody who doesn't want them fed grains or whatever their wish is for the product, or cage-free chickens is another, you know, option. That's fine if somebody wants those, but they have to be able to pay for that if they want that to continue, or else they have to start growing it themselves. And I think we're at a point right now, especially in America, where people want all that stuff and don't want to pay for it all at the same time. And they're regulating it away from the local producer and more towards the larger producers, and incentivizing more corporatization to come in.
I understand that perfectly, because that is my case. I spend my savings, and I have to cut in other parts of my budget in order to afford what I can. When I cannot afford it, I don't eat it. But I guess if everybody wants the health and of the people is what it makes a prosperous country, not just a few.
Someone asked a question here in the audience. Yes, it is true. Antibiotics do not remain in our meat. Every antibiotic has been tested to have a specific withdrawal period. So if Brian has to treat an animal with an antibiotic, he has a specific withdrawal time for that drug that he used before he can move that animal into the meat processing. So that is very strictly regulated. And like I said, if you get caught with antibiotic residue or something like that, the consequences are usually not very good for you. So feedlot operators are very, very careful when it comes to withdrawal periods. They have sick pens where they'll put cattle off to the side, so that they can not only monitor them, but also keep track of when that animal is able to move back in to the herd or to the lot, or move into the packer supply chain. So
I want to ask a question. So when you are grocery shopping for meat, and you can tell there's been some sort of abscess or something peculiar cut off the meat because you see some residue from it, you can rest assured that it's not an issue.
Yeah.
None of that makes it to the grocery store shelves, though.
No.
Let's be clear about that.
No.
So you're not going to see that on the grocery store. They're going to see that in the processing room where they're breaking down the cuts into whatever they're making. And if it is, it's put on as a null roll or as a dark cutter, and that meat does not go into the human food supply chain. It then gets rerouted to pet food, like dogs and cats, because it's still healthy and there's nothing wrong with it. In that case, it can go that way. So, none of that makes it to the counter at your local grocery store.
Mm.
Not supposed to, anyway.
Because I have actually seen, I'm not going to say I know what it is, but it looks like maybe there was an abscess, a sore, something that doesn't look normal. And maybe it's because I don't know what normal is when you talk about cutting and processing meat. But if it doesn't look like something I want to eat, I'm not going to buy it. But I have seen those things. But again, what I'm asking is if a person does see something odd, they are pretty... you're pretty confident that it's nothing that's going to hurt.
No, it's not going to hurt you. No.
The only way it could is if that meat happened to get rotten or something because it wasn't stored properly at the retailer, but it's nothing from the processing that made it through the line, I guess.
if you see
something undesirable, yeah, you have every right not to buy that cut of meat, but everything when it was processed was safe, but it's just, you know, safe food handling. Sometimes something could happen at the grocery store or it's sat in the counter and got shoved around. I don't know. That's the only thing I would have to think about there. But the American meat supply is the safest in the world, even though Europe tends to think theirs is safer because of all their added regulations.
Yep. And if you
did,
go ahead, Mark.
Australians made it the safest in the world anyway.
I knew that was coming.
No, I was just gonna add to the confidence in Australia in the milk industry, which I don't like talking about. But if a tanker of milk arrives at the factory, they test it before they unload it. And if there's any antibiotics in the mix, then they discard the whole lot. And the person who was responsible for putting those antibiotics in, because they test each particular farm, has to pay for the milk that they dump. So there's a lot of disincentive to not put antibiotics in your milk, or at least go to with the withholding periods to make sure it's not in there.
Same here in the U.S.
By the way...
And if you did find...
Sorry, I just thought something. In certified organic, we are allowed to use antibiotics, but it's only to save the life of the cow or, you know, the injury or whatever. And that cow is usually discarded from production after that. There's like a 3-month or 6-month withholding period. So there's no use keeping her in calf or in milk. So we just usually dry them off and either put them back out to pasture or they go to the sale barn.
Now, I'm not going to say there probably never has been something that has got to the meat counter that shouldn't have, but it would be a almost catastrophic failure of our USDA inspection system and all of that. So the chances are so remote that something like that would get to the meat counter that it's not even worth considering. So
let's just say you're 2 to 3 times as likely to get produce that has some kind of contamination, salmonella, E. coli, than meat.
Yep.
In America.
I would agree. Yep. So. Yep.
if you see something you don't like, that's fine, but ask questions to learn more, and I appreciate you asking in here so that we can help work through this together so everybody learns and continues to grow, because that is what's important, is people just making assumptions that something they see is horrible, or people who, hey, I saw this, what is that? That's more the right attitude to have. So thank you.
Absolutely.
I appreciate that, Brian, a lot, because it is the trust that we have in what we is important, because people trust a lot in the people who is managing the food, and it is a very good thing to have. It's just the other things that you know don't complement that then it seems just for one kind of people and not for everybody. And that's the thing that bothers me, because the people who really needed it, because they are replacing all that with medicines that really don't need to be taken, if we have what the body needs in the food.
Hey, I want to ask one more thing, just to be sure. The process also applies to small farms who have like local meat markets, not just commercial grocers, right?
So a lot of the big processors that sell to your grocers are federally inspected, USDA inspected. A lot of the local processors are state inspected. Now, some of those state inspections also carry over, like South Dakota. Like if Brian got a steer processed in South Dakota, the local market, some of those carry over to, or he can sell it into Iowa, if I remember right. I think there's a South Dakota-Iowa agreement there that Iowa says that...
There's like 10 states that have reciprocity that they trust the other state inspection qualifications to meet their local state inspection qualifications.
Reprocess.
So they're not U.S. Yeah, they're not USDA inspected, but they are state inspected, which I'm going to be honest, a lot of the state inspections are harder than the USDA inspections, mainly because for two reasons. I don't think the state inspectors want to do all the work. They want it to be on USDA. And two, they don't want to be the one that inspects a plant and gets the state kicked out of the reciprocity. So they're like overcautious about it if it's state inspected. And anybody selling at a farmer's market has to be state inspected at a minimum, or USDA inspected. I think the only caveat there is, can you like process 1,000 chickens in your backyard through, you know, like a state certified means? I think is the only caveat where someone isn't like actually present watching the whole process of it. But maybe somebody can quantify that. But yeah, everything still is under the, whatever you want to call it, Food Safe Acts and stuff in America, that you can't just sell meat like you can produce. I could go pick that out of the garden and put it out there, even if I had, you know, chickens pooping on the tomato, and bring it right into town just by washing off the poop, and I'm not inspected or certified. But when it comes to meat, it has to be inspected or certified with a state recognized label. So yeah, it's very stringent on the meat side, what you can or can't do. And if they don't have a state inspected or USDA label, and it says not, it has to say not for sale. But to be honest, I'd rather have the not for sale beef that was processed at my local butcher than the USDA inspected stuff, mainly because it's just less hassle. They make more money. I sell the beef live to somebody. The processor processes it. They're still state inspected, but they're not like, they don't have to be watched for every process of the step. They're qualified, know what they're doing, can process and break it down. We have a friend who joins us here quite often who's become certified to do custom exempt, and he can do retail cuts as long as he's buying stuff that's been USDA certified. He can buy box beef and then make it into like jerkies or roasts or corned beef, which he does an awesome job of making corned beef. But he can't sell meat off of an animal I bring him. It has to be an animal that's USDA inspected. So it's kind of crazy how strict some of the laws are. And yeah, as far as antibiotic usage, everything's got a withdrawal period before it goes in and it's certified and regulated. And you won't be a beef producer for long if you sent stuff in to anywhere that wasn't off of its withdrawal period. So I do appreciate the questions and sorry for the long-winded answer.
Nope. Appreciate that. Good, good questions. Anybody else? Thoughts, comments, questions? We got somebody in here who knows what he's talking about. So you take advantage of him.
It's a good thing you're here, Shannon and Mark.
Oh.
I can't tell you how much I appreciate that because I know that there is, you know, some real concerns about, you know, the beef and just livestock in general among common people who believe that a lot of this stuff has, like, you know, steroids and, you know, that these animals are eating grain that has had pesticides, you know, in them, and therefore they believe that the meat has those same pesticides, you know, all of those things. And it's great to be able to, you know, talk directly to people who are in the agriculture about it and just see to what extent some of this stuff is just, you know, TikTok and Instagram foolishness and what parts are really true. So thank you guys for adding some value to just understanding our food source, because, you know, it's really important. So thank you.
We try.
Yeah. Yeah, and one of the biggest things when you talk about some of that stuff is, sure, it's clickbaity. People are worried. You don't have to, quote-unquote, wash your meat after you get it. You just have to cook it properly to whatever given temp. And are there different concerns from pork to chicken to beef? Yeah, that's why beef you can cook rare, while pork you have to cook well done, because there are concerns of just bacteria that live in different animals. And it's not a health or safety concern by any means. It's just a fact of nature, I guess, similar to you don't just get a head of lettuce and eat it without rinsing it off from the grocery store, because guess what? There's how many hands that have touched that head of lettuce by the time it got to your house that, yeah, you rinse it off and it's relatively safe. You know, there's a chance it could have salmonella or E. coli, but that doesn't mean that relatively safe means we can't eat it at all. Oh, there was another point I had. I can't remember it at this moment, but the biggest thing is do we use antibiotics? Do we use pesticides? Do we feed them grain? Yes. But it's just like, if you wash your hands, you're not going to get all the germs off your hands. So there's always a case of, hey, there's a drop of a germ. But a drop of a germ is way different than taking a bath in germs when you shower and get cleaned up. So just kind of think of it that way. It's a concentration effect, not a presence effect. Because a lot of people get worried like, oh, they detected the presence of this chemical or that chemical. Okay, you can detect the presence of a lot of things, but I'd be more worried about going golfing on my local golf course and getting pesticides on me than getting beef or produce from a grocery store or a farmer's market, you know, as a whole, because there's more pesticides on the commercial lawn in front of your grocery store than what you're going to be exposed to through the food growing process due to withdrawal periods and all that stuff. So, I mean, let's just be honest about calling a spade. And is it something to pay attention to? Absolutely. Is it something to panic or spread fear on? No, but guess what sells? Fear sells. Truth in science doesn't necessarily sell when you look at the whole systems approach. Are certain things bad? Yes, but water can also kill you as a toxin if you drink too much. So it's all about the dose that makes the poison, not that something's poisonous. And if there's any instance of it, it's going to be bad. So I guess that's the biggest thing I hope everyone here today can take home and share.
Good points, Brian. Anybody else? Okay, so I want to get to Soma's question. We're going, we're well off the plan today, so what the heck, we'll just stay off. So he asked, the poultry industry drastically reduced antibiotics. And he was reading about this. So if you go back to the early 1950s, somewhere in that vicinity, antibiotics started being used in poultry. And up until about the, I think it was the early 2000s, if I remember correctly, and somebody can correct me if I'm wrong, it became pretty rampant that antibiotics were in poultry. It was a way for them to grow faster. It was a way for them to prevent a lot of the diseases as people brought these animals into closer proximity in these barns and things. Well, in the early 2000s, there was a lot of increased scrutiny about the antibiotics that were being used. And that brought around some changes from, I think it was the FDA, I'm pretty sure it was the FDA, not the USDA. And that started making changes in the way that poultry producers had to apply antibiotics to the poultry industry. And so we saw a lot of changes between the early 2000s and now. And so, as mentioned in 2018, a lot changed when we got the veterinary directive that required everybody to have a prescription. I think it was, like I said, 2022, I think it was, when we got the second phase of that, which really limited what anybody could get on their own and apply. So that really tightened up the ability of people just to indiscriminately add things in the poultry industry, especially. So while a lot of people, and myself included, were not happy with the 2018 directive, which limited the ability for people just to do their own thing and do the right thing. But it's like a lot of things in life, a few bad apples ruin the whole bunch. And in hindsight, that really did tighten up the industry. That really did clean up a lot of the bad actors and force them to come to the table to put a good product into the market, a cleaner, safer product into the market overall. You know, you had producers like Brian and Kyle and those guys who were already doing the right things. They were already responsible. They were very careful. They were following all the rules and letters of the law. But like I said, it's a few bad apples that were making the bad decisions that led to us getting these new rules. And
I'm going to save that. You called me responsible.
I know. You better clip that one out while you're at it. It's a good thing we're not on video. It's really made the U.S. meat supply one of the safest in the world. Australia is pretty safe. The EU is pretty safe. But to say that they are safer than us at this point, No, I would not probably push it that far. U.S. producers have a lot of rules. They have a lot of regulations that they have to toe the line on. The consequences of not towing those lines is very detrimental. It comes with pretty hefty fines. And typically it comes with a lot of scrutiny from other producers. So it doesn't behoove anybody to now be pushing that line if you can so help it. Now, having said that, in these tough economic times, when people get pushed into a corner, people get tempted to take shortcuts. I'm not going to say it doesn't happen. But hopefully people remember that doing the right thing is good to do the right thing. And it's good for the industry. It's good for the consumers.
So when I want to just maybe clarify a little bit. When you say people take shortcuts, it's kind of like driving through the gas station to make a right-hand turn instead of going all the way to the stoplight. It's not way out of field.
No.
In most instances.
No.
So I want to clarify that because I assume that's what Shannon means because I've talked to him long enough. So just for replay sake, that's what it is. It's not anything that's, you know, hurtful or harmful or horrible, but it is illegal to make a right-hand turn through a gas station if you aren't stopping for gas.
Yep. It's nice to have a team you've worked with for 5 years. They're good at clarifying exactly what you meant, even though you didn't say it. So, all righty. Any other thoughts, comments, questions, things like that?
I just had to say that because that's my thoughts of, you know, this is the rule, and then this is what we do sometimes, and then this is what's bad. Yep. And they're not all the same thing. Just because you don't follow the rules doesn't mean that you're doing something horrible or bad. It's just something that's been put in place because there is a bad actor that's been, you know, pushing the edges of the rules too much. So we put another rule in and another rule in. So I guess that's kind of why do we not want people to turn at a gas station instead of going to the light? Well, because it could cause an accident, somebody trying to cut through the gas station when people are actually trying to get gas and going and get something from the C-store inside. So it's just, it's one of those things that a bad outcome could happen, most likely doesn't.
Hopefully doesn't, yeah. Anybody else? Thank you, Brian. All righty.
Oh, Brian, you just triggered another thought that I had when I was teaching my son to drive. I told him that once we get into the car, our priority is not to get to the place that we are going, is to be safe and in the road, to have all the attention in the road and respect the rules. And if I'm late, I had to get up a little early to in order to do all those things. So thank you so much.
All righty. So the Canada-US-Mexico trade deal, it has been talked about a lot here the last few years, as Canada and the U.S. and Mexico have disagreed on a lot of things. The American Food and Ag groups, read in their lobby groups, if you will, are calling for a full 16-year renewal of this agreement. So they said that the value chain is why they express support for the agreement, because it allows ag exports from the United States to prosper. So the letter argues that this agreement in the U.S. has helped not only American farmers, but also facilitated a flow of commerce between all three countries. A lot of ag commodities have benefited from new or expanded market access in both Canada and Mexico, amplified by the preservation of the zero tariff provisions retained in that agreement. So they said any adjustment should be carefully considered in order to avoid negative impacts on ag. So Canada is the largest or second largest market for a lot of the products that we grow or produce here in the U.S. Also, they argued that American family farms depend on the stability from that agreement for multi-year planning, and without it, farmers would be saddled with more cost related to transportation and compliance. The letter said, that had all these organizations signed on to it, said that we're deeper reliant on trade, and our closest neighbors are the strongest trading partners for U.S. ag and its continued success. We stand ready to provide the expertise needed to maintain U.S. leadership within this agreement and advocate for the continued trade certainty that it provides. So it was originally negotiated in 2018. It is set for review in the summer of 2026, which is the way our government responds to things, which probably means it's about tomorrow in their case. if you've been in this for a certain amount of time, I don't have a lot of love for the U.S. government sometimes. So while this agreement has been beneficial in some aspects, it also has been detrimental in others. For one, it does not allow each country to say, well, I'm not going to take this and we want a different product. Example, Mexico not wanting GMO corn. The U.S. threw a hissy fit. They wanted to continue to push GMO corn into Mexico for livestock feed. Mexicans were not happy about that, obviously, and it had to go to arbitration. Canada and the U.S. have been at it about dairy. Also, there is some things that Canada sets tariffs on that, in my opinion, really shouldn't if we have this free trade agreement. So I'm not a big fan of these groups anymore, these ag groups. They do serve somewhat of a purpose, but in some cases they think they have gotten a lot bigger britches than they actually do. And in some cases they are not as representative as they claim of farmers and ranchers. So I'm just going to leave it there. But yeah, I'm not sure that a full renewal of that trade agreement is necessarily, in at least to the U.S.'s best interest. But too bad Brian got on the phone because I was going to hear what he had to say. Oh, well. Any thoughts, any comments?
Just a quick question, Sean. The soybean export to China was stopped. Was the recent meeting between America and China helpful in resolving that issue?
Yes. Well, according to the media and government mouthpieces, yes. They have supposedly, and nobody's seen the full paperwork on this as of yesterday.
Yes, soybeans actually get shipped.
Yes. On paper, they sold 25 tons, metric tons, and they're guaranteed of selling 20 metric tons each of the next 3 years. Whether China holds to their end of the deal is a whole different conversation, as everybody knows. But at this point in time, China has agreed to take 25 million metric tons this year, and 20 million metric tons each of the next 3 years. So, but we'll just have to see if they abide by their agreement and actually hold to it.
That's great. That's great news for American farmers. Well done.
Well, we hope it is. We still have a lot of crop to get rid of. Soybeans were absolutely incredible this year, as far as yields go. So we're going to have a lot to get rid of in the meantime. So we'll see. It should have been double that. Then we'd probably be in a lot better shape. But
all right, I blanked out. What were you talking about before, Shannon? I was here. But now I ADHD'd out.
The Canada-U.S. Yeah.
States, senators, and representatives days before that actually got passed in D.C., so I do remember it well. It was a great deal compared to no deal that we had before. Has there been some hiccups with it and some things that I would like to see changed with you? Yeah, I think I'm mostly on the same page as you for some of the hand tying that was done with that. I guess some of the corn requirements going to Mexico, I believe, is one of those in there that I would like to see changed, because science has shown that what they want and what is actually necessary don't match up. It's back to some more of that protectionism that some of these countries do for their products, which is fine. They have a right to do that, but it doesn't mean that it's fully true and right that what needs to be done. I guess, at least in my opinion, based on talking to scientists and different people who, you know, develop different production methods of corn. And that's a whole rabbit trail that we've kind of touched on many times today. So anyhow, yeah, the biggest thing is I'd rather see it continued than not, but I'm with you, Shannon. I think I'd like to see a few changes that would be more beneficial to our marketing perspective. But we do a lot of trade with Canada and Mexico, and right now I'm sure it's kind of in jeopardy with us not taking any cattle from Mexico due to the New World screwworm. It really has halted some of our negotiation abilities. I guess that's how I'll word it for now, because it's just very complicated. But anyhow, yeah, I'd like to see it redone than not, but it would be nice to see a few changes. I don't know. We'll see what happens here with Mexican leadership and Canadian leadership kind of being changed around here recently.
Well, and I'm not sure the trade organizations are as beneficial for American producers going into this, what they're pushing for, you know, redoing this deal or renewal of this deal as they should be. I don't trust them to do right, I guess, to make those changes. So, alrighty, one of the last articles I want to get to today, and I want to get to this just for Mark's sake. So glyphosate is something we talk about a lot in this room because people bring great questions to the table, and they obviously listen to the news, they listen to a lot of talking heads, and some of it is fear-mongering, some of it is ill-informed, or they leave out a lot of details, and that makes the public question things. And we continue to get better research, we continue to learn more, we are hopefully getting better at this. But the Kiwis, New Zealand, food safety has decided to keep glyphosate residue limits the same. This was after public consultation. So there was a proposal to the food safety down there to change maximum residue levels for glyphosate in wheat, barley, and oats to 10 milligrams per kilogram. However, the food safety committee set the limit, or kept the limit at 0.1 milligrams per kilogram. The deputy director general for that group said the decision reflects changes in how growers are using glyphosate. He said, quote, although we are confident the proposed limits would not have presented any health risk to consumers, after considering the more than 3,000 submissions and meeting with a broad range of stakeholders, we found compelling evidence that the way glyphosate is used in New Zealand has changed over the past 5 or 6 years. Growers and millers have increasingly entered into contractual arrangements that require no or extremely low glyphosate residues in grains used for food, effectively prohibiting pre-harvest use of glyphosate. So for dry field peas, though, the maximum residue limit has been set at 6 milligrams per kilogram, and that is in line with industry ag practices in Australia, the European Union, and the United Kingdom. The United States has an 8 milligram per kilogram limit. So New Zealand food safety will require that when glyphosate is used on wheat, barley, and oats grown for human consumption, it can only be applied before the crops emerge. It will not be allowed to be used directly on cereal crops grown for people to eat. In November of 23, the European Commission renewed the approval of glyphosate until December of 2033. So the deputy director said, quote, glyphosate helps manage outbreaks of pests and diseases. They reduce the risk to plant and animal health, and they help keep our food prices down. Because crops and animals can produce more when there are fewer pests. And I think he was talking about general chemicals, but anyway, we'll go with that. So Greenpeace, who most of us are not a fan of, welcomed the move and called on New Zealand Food Safety to restart their glyphosate testing program. So, let's see. Where is this guy from? I don't even know how to pronounce this. A gentleman from a environmental group said New Zealanders want a food system that prioritizes health, integrity, and environmental protection over chemical convenience. We commend the commission for listening to that message and recognizing the shift already happening on farms away from reliance on glyphosate toward more sustainable organic practices. So maybe this is a step too far in not allowing any post-emergence glyphosate application, but I do commend them on banning the desiccant portion of using glyphosate. I wish Canada would do that, and I wish the U.S. would do that. So what a lot of, not a lot, some producers use, especially in Canada, is they will use a desiccant to help that crop die down faster so they can get to harvest. The weather in Canada is not a long growing season, so they use a desiccant to help that crop die down faster so they can get the crop out before the snow flies. However, when you use a chemical like glyphosate as a desiccant, that plant is trying to finish out the seed portion, and the seed is what goes to consumers. That chemical gets taken up by the plant, and whatever it takes up at that point is going into the seed for the most part. So that's where we get some of these residue limits on that. Now, I am not against applying glyphosate or some chemicals early in the plant's life, especially if it's going to help kill some of those weeds that are going to limit yield. But I do, like I said, want to commend New Zealand for banning the desiccant portion of glyphosate use. Mark, if you're available, I'll give you first shot at this.
Can you hear me all right, or am I in the hole?
I can, loud and clear.
Good-o. I agree. I think that that's a really great thing. I'm not an abolitionist. I don't believe that we should ban things. I feel like farmers should have the choice to move back to what is better for the consumer, and the consumer should drive that. And this is kind of drawing the attention to that thing. Just ever increasing, it's not ideal, I don't think. You know, if it goes above a limit and you're ever increasing the glyphosate in the food product, then it should be have a set limit on it, I believe. I believe in transparency of what we're doing on the farms, and then consumers can make up their own mind and then buy accordingly to what they want. If they don't worry about that, then that's fine. They can buy that product. But if they want a product that's got less in it or none, hopefully like mine, I've just had my property tested, so I can say that. And then they should have, you know, consumer choice, and then the market should drive the farmer's behavior and not some sort of legal thing. But, you know, similarly to what Brian was saying earlier, you know, bad actors get in there and they do the wrong thing, and then we have to put in laws that we probably don't even really need to control these things. And I think this is probably partly it, people overusing glyphosate. And I think the desiccation is the worst one, because at the time when the crop is killed, it's building seed, and most of that Roundup, I believe, according to Don Huber, is going to end up in the reproductive organs, which is the seed, and you're going to eat it. So I agree with what you're saying, Shannon, and I think it's a great move to just move things slightly to stop the bad actors and not be abolitionists accordingly.
Absolutely. All righty. Any other thoughts? Thank you, Mark, or comments? All right. I think we've reached the end of the week.
Shannon?
Yes, sir.
The important thing, glyphosate is a great tool in our toolbox to limit tillage, to limit different fuel consumptions of tractors, because I don't want to go back to tilling in the fall and the spring again, and then cultivating rows. So, yes, Yep, I agree. It's a good tool. We just need to use it judicially, and we really need to look at the science. And the more I listen to actual scientists who talk about it, the more I understand that, yeah, people say glyphosate can intrude on your gut health, and it can be harmful there. That's true, but we also need to make sure that that's the only thing that is in there and that we aren't having other things too, because it's easy to blame one big bad thing than to actually try and figure out what we're doing and how to make that better. So as a producer who uses it as a beneficial tool, specifically in the spring and in the fall to kind of kill down some stuff so that I don't have any carryover of seed for next year. Yeah, it's a great tool. We don't need to ban it outright, but let's use some judicial actions to use it properly so we can continue using it, because it's way safer than a bunch of the other products on the market.
Yeah. One of the, oh, you just triggered a thought that I meant to mention when I was going through the article. When we get to small grain production, like wheat, oats, barley, those things, to Brian's point, we can't pull a cultivator through those crops. It doesn't obviously work. So we need some way to get rid of those weeds. And early chemical pass is a good way to do that, so that that small grain crop can get up, shade the ground, and naturally start killing the weeds. So small grain production especially, it is nice to have a tool in the toolbox that we can get rid of some of those weeds that we don't necessarily want, or that are going to cost us production and money. So, all righty. Last article of the week. Go ahead, Mark.
Before we move to the next article, I was just going to add an organic biodynamics perspective. There are some organic sprays out now which are increasing the use, which is great. I think they're made from pine needles. I can't remember the name of the acid. Left my mind. It's Sundown. I'm just on market. So that's good to see that there are products that are even more safer than Roundup being used. And they are, some of them are organically certified, although biodynamic people won't use them through fear of soil biology because we look after that. We will use weeds in our biodynamic realm. Anyway, I can't speak for the organic guys. We use the weeds actually as fertilizer. For example, if there was a weed, 5 inches high or something, and we would actually plow that in and spray it with our Preparation 500, which is like a probiotic for soil, and that would break down into a humus form, and that would be crop, fertilizer for the next crop. So we kind of use our weeds in that regard. So I just wanted to point that out, that there are new things coming along, and there's lasers too, and there's new weeds with weeding machines, which are not very light tillage, just tickles the soil when the weeds are very small. And lasers are being used now. So I feel like we're coming into a new realm anyway as far as weeds.
Okay, this is tongue-in-cheek. I want everybody who isn't in the know to know this. But, Mark, I'm going to send you some Palmer amaranth and Canadian thistle seed, and you can have all of it you want to till into your soil. So, all right.
Those are two of the nastiest buggers to try to get rid of. If you're not familiar with...
To illustrate Brian's point of it, there are some noxious weeds out there that you need a weed killer with. Like, I've got some blackberries in the corner of my property, and I don't know what in the hell I'm going to do with them. I'm going to have to get an excavator in to get them out. So, and that's why I say I'm not against chemicals. They are tools in the toolbox. But I just believe, we just got to watch the overuse, and most farmers are pretty good. It's just, as we said, there's bad actors there, and we've got to make sure they're not doing the wrong thing.
Absolutely. Anybody else? Thoughts, comments? All right. Sleep. Sleep is something that some of us don't get a lot of. Or we don't get good sleep. And nutrition can be a key component of us not getting good sleep or any sleep at all.
I got good sleep. I got like a whole 4 hours last night. What are you talking about?
Oh, geez. I'm going to have to talk to Sarah about that. I don't know why she's letting you sleep that long. But sleep can be a key health goal.
Brian, Brian's been bloody slack with 4 hours. Goodness gracious.
I know. I mean, that's for us old people. I mean, geez. So the food industry has an opportunity to meet consumer demands. So as Thanksgiving is around the corner, one of the great ingredients that helps sleep quality is tryptophan. It's in turkey, by the way, if you didn't pick that up.
That's why Thanksgiving turkey really puts you to sleep.
It does. So tryptophan boosts melatonin and serotonin for better sleep regulation. And we're going to go through a little more in depth on all these. Magnesium can help support REM sleep and melatonin production in older adults. Thank goodness I'm not there yet. But potassium reduces nighttime disturbances and improves muscle relaxation. Melatonin-rich foods enhance sleep onset and overall sleep quality. And L-theanine lowers anxiety and helps shorten time to fall asleep. So there's really not any debate among legitimate scientists that a good night's sleep is healthy, whether that's 4 hours of good solid sleep or maybe 8 hours that some of us require. What ingredients can help us improve our sleep? So globally, 57.6% of consumers cite getting better sleep as a key health goal. And that is the highest of any of the health goals surveyed by Lumina Intelligence. So sleep is the top health goal for consumers between 18 and 54. And in consumers over the age of 54, it was only edged out by aging and good health and longevity. Consumers in Asia prioritize better sleep over anything else. So how can we do this? Tryptophan. It's an essential amino acid. It leads to the production, like I said, of melatonin and serotonin. But tryptophan is modulated by the gut microbiome. And it must be obtained entirely from dietary sources, because the human body cannot synthesize it. So to take effect, tryptophan must cross the blood-brain barrier. And to do that, it has to compete with other amino acids. What scientists have found is combining tryptophan with carbohydrates is the best way to increase its advantage. That's why if you have Thanksgiving turkey and you eat some mashed potatoes along with it, that's why when you sit down in the easy chair, you are asleep in very short order. But there are a lot of foods rich in tryptophan. Dairy products, fish, seeds, nuts, eggs, other kinds of meat besides turkey, soybeans, oats, and bananas. And there are some companies out there that have made corn flour tortillas and baby formula that is fortified with tryptophan. Magnesium. In increasing amounts of studies, this has been found to improve sleep through its effectiveness, but a lot of it depends on the source of the magnesium. And one study showed that L-threonate, I think, T-H-R-E-O-N-A-T-E, magnesium type, can cross the blood-brain barrier. And it's particularly effective in improving the quality of sleep. A study that was done on elderly participants with insomnia linked magnesium to an increase in melatonin. So good sources of magnesium include spinach, nuts, and wholemeal bread. Now, foods can be fortified with magnesium, and there are some energy bars out there that are fortified with that. Potassium. One study found that potassium, in combination with magnesium, can increase our melatonin levels and mitigate the effects of insomnia, especially in
patients with diabetes. Another study in Japan has linked consumption of potassium before bedtime to fewer sleep disturbances during the night. So a lot of previous studies have linked low potassium intake to sleepiness during the day, waking up at night, and poor sleep quality. So potassium plays a key role in muscle function. So if we can allow those muscles to relax during sleep, we got a better chance. So potassium is found, of course, in bananas, but also beans and pulses, nuts and seeds, fish, vegetables like broccoli, and I hate to even mention this next one, Brussels sprouts, and parsnips, along with chicken, beef, and turkey. Now, potassium also is sometimes added to foods in the form of potassium chloride, which is a salt substitute. Number four, melatonin. So melatonin is a hormone that occurs naturally in the human body. When we go to sleep, our levels of melatonin rise, and then they fall in the morning. But it can be found in food. It occurs naturally in tart cherries, eggs, fish, and nuts, along with some of our cereals, some kinds of mushrooms, and germinated legumes. Consumption of foods containing melatonin leads to better sleep. A study was done on school children and students, linking higher consumption of melatonin-rich foods to better quality of sleep. So make sure your kids are getting plenty of tart cherries, eggs, fish, nuts, and so on. Maybe get them to go to sleep a little better. So while the production of melatonin is currently challenging research, in the fact of producing more melatonin-rich foods. So in one study, biofortified soybeans exhibited a 31% increase in melatonin content without a detrimental impact on yield. L-theanine, that's an amino acid that is often found in tea, most prominently green tea. And a variety of studies have linked it to improved sleep. One review suggested it could be used as a sleep aid because it is not a sedative, but it induces anxiolysis. Anybody can pronounce that, go ahead. Which is reduced anxiety or relaxation. Another review found that this both improves subjective sleep and onset latency, which is the time it takes you to fall asleep, along with the subjective quality of sleep. Now, it occurs naturally in tea, but it can be added to functional drinks or even functional beer, which would help Kyle on occasion. So they tell us here to avoid certain ingredients before if we want a good night's sleep. They mention coffee right off the bat as that is a stimulant and that can last 3 to 4 hours after ingestion. They say consumers should avoid alcohol.
That's a lie.
I agree with you. Consumers should avoid alcohol as well if they want to have a good quality sleep. Alcohol is quickly metabolized, causing one to wake up several times in the night without withdrawal symptoms. Withdrawal has the opposite effect of alcohol itself, making the consumer restless instead of tired. Any thoughts, any comments?
Yeah, their claim about coffee and caffeine is incorrect. I can slam an energy drink and go right to sleep. In fact, if I want to go to sleep, that's what I do. It works. It calms me.
I think part of that has to do with the military background, Kyle, because if you can fall asleep on a C-130, a little coffee before bed is not going to hurt you.
Well,
just speaking from personal experience. All righty.
That study was specifically referencing neurotypicals, not ADHD people.
That is true, too. Oh. So Todd says tryptophan from turkey appreciably affecting tiredness is a myth with a thread of biochemical truth. I don't know. If I eat turkey and mashed potatoes together, I'm pretty much guaranteed to fall asleep in the chair. That's pretty much a given. So, but I'm not.
I guess that's for all people.
Thanks, Maria. I appreciate that. Don't know what I'm going to do when I get old, but.
So you may. Sorry.
Oh, go ahead, Mark.
So you mean old people are now called magnesium people? So I must be magnesium man then.
Not sure what you're gonna do when you get old, Mark. All righty. Anybody else? Thoughts or comments?
Oh, to say that I found amongst university students, they find ashwagandha very popular, especially for reducing stress for exams, which has a side effect of, I found it from my own children, one in particular, who I saw slept a lot when he took ashwagandha. So I banned him from from using it because I gave him other supplements which I thought were more useful. But it's amazing how the youth are amazing, because I've been a phytochemist for over 30 years. And if I tell my children, this plant is good for you, or this botanical is good for you, it goes over their head. But if their friends tell them, they'll buy it the next day. It's amazing. the power of peer pressure really is amazing. So if you can get to the youngsters at this impressionable age, then... finding a way to get them to become more healthy. I mean, I love it. I mean, the youngsters today, they're going to the gym a lot more. They're eating healthier a lot more. But they're giving advice to each other rather than getting advice from us so-called older educated people. So the other, let's have a look, what other plant did I say?
Valerian
and chamomile are the two traditional ones. But it's interesting that in the UK in 2007, we were forced to go through a period, because of Europe, a period of re-registering all our botanical products with the MHRA type. It's like your FDA.
Mm-hmm.
And if there wasn't any tradition of using those plants in the country that you're selling it with, if there wasn't a 15-year history, then you had to pay a lot of money to get the product re-registered. And a lot of products went off sale in the UK. 2007 was a big turning point for these type of traditional supplements. I don't know if anybody else has come across this ashwagandha. I'm not a great advocate of it, but it looks like a multi-million pound product.
Well, I'm glad you pronounced it, because I wasn't even going to try.
Don't ask me to spell it, though.
Oh, anybody else? Thoughts or comments?
Yes, I am. I we have to find the way to when we what happened is to feed our kids, we have to name it other things so that, because they don't know. So if we explain them what we are putting into the food, maybe maybe they don't gonna understand, but they're going to see the benefits. And I have a vivid example of that. I didn't know that it was cojones al carbón that my dad gave us until I realized that the benefits of that. Thank you.
Thank you. Anybody else? All righty. As always, these rooms are recorded. You can always go back and re-listen to anything you might have missed or any questions that you want to resolve, or come back later and we'll do them. Next week, Thursday, I'm out. I got a bunch of meetings. Friday, I think I'm going to get back in time, so we'll play Friday by ear next week, just in case I don't get back from a couple meetings I got to go to. But Tuesday, Wednesday, and Saturday, we definitely will be hosting rooms. So we look forward to having everybody here, accordingly, and it should be a fun time. We'll see what we come up with for next week. The determination was, and this was Kyle's idea originally, to give credit where credit is absolutely due. We're going to continue to play a song whenever Shannon remembers. to end the rooms, because it was such a good idea. So with that, everybody have an awesome weekend, and we will get to the music here.
Salute, Shannon. Thank you.
Absolutely. Thanks a million, folks. It's awesome, as always, to do these rooms. Thank you, Brian, for all the assistance today. Added immense value, as always. Maria, great questions. Larry, I hope you have a safe trip or had a safe trip. Appreciate you sticking with us. Everybody have an awesome weekend. We'll see everybody Tuesday night, 6 p.m. Central. Have a great one.